Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Economics. It will also be cross-posted on New Books in Conflict Studies and New Books in Peace Research. My name is Sydney, and today I have Jan Selby, who's a professor in the UK and has written a book called Divided Environments, an International Political Ecology of Climate Change, Water, and Security, along with his co-authors Gabriel Dow and Clemens Hoffman. Professor Selby, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for being here. Do you want to just start us off by telling us sort of why it is that you wrote this book? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be the person writing this book. Just sort of like the fun backstory of how these sort of this book ended up in my hands.
Thanks ever so much, Sydney. So this book is, I mean, it goes back, its genesis goes back quite a way, really. It goes back to 2009, 2010, when we had the initial idea for this book, which came out of initially out of an EU funded project on which Clemens and I were working together, and then all kinds of other things got in the way, and personal life, other academic pressures, nothing happened with the book, and then it was rethought in around 2016. At a certain point, Gabrielle came on board to help as well, and the book is at last done and published. So it's got a long backstory. To say something a little bit more about it intellectually and how I came to it. I've been working on issues to do with water politics, water conflict for many years. I did my PhD on Israeli-Palestinian water politics. And had a book which was published in 2003 from my PhD. I've written various other things around issues to do with water politics, and it was via that interest in water politics and environmental politics more broadly, and water conflict, water security questions, I should say in particular, that I started to enter into some of the debates around the conflict and security implications of climate change. So that interest in climate change, which really started with this EU project that went back to 2010 to 2012, led me with a number of collaborators, including Clemens and Gabrielle, to examine conflict implications of conflict security implications of climate change. So together with those collaborators, with Gabrielle and Clemens and others, I've done various bits of work over the years, looking at a number of different cases. I've written on the claims about the role of climate change in the Syrian civil war. I've written on Sudan. I've written with Gabrielle on the Lake Chad region, and also as well as some more general and theoretical stuff. And this book really tries to pull the threads of a lot of that stuff together into something which hopefully is reasonably coherent, and to offer not only a critique of some claims that have been made, which is partly what the book does, but also offer a different overall account of what we see as the conflict and security implications of climate change. in which water plays a central role as our sort of analytical focus for thinking about the conflict security implications of climate change. So that's the backdrop.
Awesome. There's a lot to unpack there, and I promise I will ask about all of these things. But first, for our audience, so that I never have to explain it to someone in a conference when I'm justifying what it is that I do all day, could you explain what political ecology is and what international political ecology might mean?
Yeah, sure. Good question. So, the probably most straightforward to say what political ecology is to say that it's the opposite of an apolitical ecology. And an apolitical ecology would be one which wouldn't foreground politics in the understanding of ecological and environmental crises. A political ecology, by contrast, is one which would foreground the political in terms of understanding ecological, environmental issues, problems, crises, and would also at the same time, tend to emphasize that ecology, nature in scare quotes, and the extraction, exploitation, transformation, mobilization of nature are central to understanding forms of politics. So it's not only that politics lies behind ecological crises, but that those ecological transformations themselves have important political consequences. So political ecology as an approach is one which sees the political and the ecological as sort of locked in a two-way embrace. I should try to clarify what politics or the political means here. It can mean a bunch of things, but normally it means something pretty broad. Normally it means something like forms of power, forms of hierarchy, forms of rule. So not simply forms of policy. So politics, power, hierarchy, and the relationship between those and also policy and transformations and exploitation of ecological systems and processes. For those who are familiar with the phrase political economy, political ecology is sometimes in shorthand talked about as political economy plus ecology. So a political economy approach that takes ecology seriously, that would not only analyze trade flows or trade liberalization, but that would link that to new processes of dredging of ports, transformation of coastlines, transformation and mobilization of water resources for export through crops, changes to and destruction of wildlife and natural ecosystems as a result, and so on and so forth, soil depletion and so on. Hopefully that gives some sense of what political ecology is. The book, hopefully it's intended in part as a contribution to but more than that is indebted to this broad swathe of work in political ecology, which is quite established as an approach. What we think is a little bit distinctive about the approach that we take in the book is that we, as the subtitle to the book suggests, our approach is what we call an international political ecology. So what's the significance of that? Just to explain that, let me say that political ecology as an approach has tend to come out of, above all, and be associated with the disciplines of geography, as well as anthropology and development studies. politics international relations scholars have tended not to make big, particularly big contributions to understanding political ecology. So at its simplest, when we our approach as an international political ecology is in a sense what one might expect from some international relations scholars trying to engage and use techniques of political ecology. So in one sense, at simplest, that's what we're doing. We're bringing together insights from critical international relations and political ecology. I think there's a slightly deeper meaning as well that I won't go into it at great length, and actually is a little bit under theorized in the book. It's not developed particularly much. We don't do a huge amount with this, but let me just say that political ecology as an approach, given the disciplines it's come out of, it's tend to have a quite localist and place-based focus, and when it but combining that often with a quite critical attitude towards prevailing state and economic orders and how they transform place, ecology and society in particular places. But when it's dealt at the bigger scale beyond place, what it has tended to do is to think is to focus on the global rather than the international. So the phrase global political ecology is one which is reasonably well established within the literature. And the issue here from our perspective is what a focus on the global does is that it doesn't pay enough attention to the existence of a multiplicity of states and an international system. And to what international relations scholars would think of as international differences and dynamics of the different developmental and therefore political ecological trajectories that happen in different national contexts, to the questions to do with state building and borders. Because of that multiplicity, doesn't pay quite enough attention to the importance of geopolitical conflicts and dynamics in how they affect political ecological processes, and so on. So in wanting to bring an international political ecology, we're trying to place more emphasis on the international as constitutive of political ecological change, and at the same time, those processes of ecological change as making and reaffirming of the international. So that's broadly what an international political ecology means.
Thank you for that. That was perfect explanation. For the readers, if you pick up this book, one thing that sort of like struck me when I was anticipating thinking about something that was international and political ecology that makes this tangible is that there are individual state actors and state actor bodies that are mentioned and whose role is discussed a lot versus sort of like larger terms you might be familiar with and like more in critical scholarship such as like capital and labor in the abstract, right? It becomes very tangible and you can see in real world events these types of events occurring. But while we're talking about the international, there's a number of case studies and places that you look at and places that you've done research and that your co-authors have done research to create this book and to create your research agenda. Could you talk about those places, how they got selected, what we learned from them, what's missing from the case studies, sort of just tell us a little bit about the sites that generate this knowledge.
Yeah, thanks. So let me explain this via the book's title, Divided Environments. The book is draws upon evidence from five cases And those five cases are all what we call divided environments in one way or another. That is, they're all territorially divided spaces or societies, and most of them what we would call in one form or another partitioned societies. So our five cases, just to say what they are, Cyprus, divided between internationally recognized Republic of Cyprus and Turkish occupied northern Cyprus, Israel Palestine, divided between Israel and the West Bank, occupied West Bank and Gaza, Sudan, divided between between now the state of Sudan and the independent state of South Sudan. Recall that the work on this went to started in 2010 or so. At that point, South Sudan was not an independent state. And then our other two cases are Syria, divided within the context of the Syrian civil war, and then the final case, which is slightly different in that it's a division which division between internationally recognized borders, is that of the Lake Chad Basin. Lake Chad lying at the border between Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. So there are five cases. The book isn't organized around those cases, I should say. We don't have a chapter on each of the cases. We dip in and out of the cases as part of our sort of analysis, and dip in and out for examples and here and there comparing and contrasting them. Let me just say how we got to those cases, linking with what I said before. So the EU project around which provided the seeds for this book was Clemens and I were going to do work on water climate conflict relations in Cyprus, Israel, Palestine, and Sudan. So, and our initial idea was for a book that would just be a three case study book, but then other stuff got in the way, and we went on to do other bits of work. And I did work on Syria, and Gabriel and I did work on Lake Chad, and that's how we came to the cases. In terms of, you also asked Sydney about the did you ask about the weaknesses of the or the problems with those cases or some of the shortcomings?
Yeah, I'm happy to hear about those. I was also wondering, sort of, when you select cases, if you think that there were, like, if there was another case or two that you're like, I would like to have done but couldn't do, but might have told me this, or sort of, yeah, just thinking about your case selection, if there was a different set of them that would have interested you that you were unable to do for other logistical reasons.
Yeah, so it's a good question. I think the answer is probably not really. There weren't really other cases that we thought about adding, but didn't. It was more the other way around that actually we needed to, when we came to rethink the book as thematically organized, when we came back to it in 2016, 2017, it was a question of, well, shall we bring the Syrian material in, and then shall we bring the Lake Chad material in? So there weren't really other cases that we'd explored in great depth that material could have been brought in on. I should say that partly because of the way the book is organized, because it's organized thematically rather than around the cases. So it does move between sort of more general and sometimes theoretical discussion, and then some quite detailed empirical engagement with the cases, and in between doing those things, we bring in bits of insights from other cases, so the odd reference to India, Pakistan, and so on and so forth. Britain appears quite a lot, the US quite a lot, so on and so forth. So, although the focus is on those cases, we do travel around a little bit beyond that. In terms of some of the limitations of those cases. I mean, They're definitely, I mean, I'm sure there are some you may have a better sense of what some of those are than me. I think we've ended up focusing on cases which are, for the most part, ones which have been quite extensively discussed within quite mainstream accounts of water and climate security. So in a sense, that provides some of the most sensible justification for why these might be good cases. So some of these cases cover what are probably the three most prominent examples which have been suggested of climate wars or climate conflicts. The war in Darfur 2003-05, the Syrian civil war, and the Lake Chad crisis. They're all sort of covered by our cases, and we investigate the claims around those. At the same time, those cases speak to some of the major transboundary waters, which are thought to be sites of potential water wars. So the Euphrates River, the Nile, and the Jordan River. So they're good cases in the sense that lots has been written about these cases already, and that's lots that we disagree with, which provides quite a useful basis and entry point for our analysis. I'm sure there are some limitations as well in terms of the types of things that we look at and some of the issues that we look at. We're mainly dealing with contexts of semi-arid environments, not solely, but mainly dealing with contexts of semi-arid environments, and clearly water politics looks different in other different national contexts. We also, I should say, don't deal particularly heavily, only in passing, really, with questions to do with sea level rise, for instance, which is an aspect of water politics, a dimension of water politics in a sense, which is clearly going to be very important in relation to climate change. So there are definitely some limitations around those cases.
Awesome. So one of the things that you mentioned that I really want to develop is that you actually selected cases about which lots in the mainstream literature has been written. I imagine there could be listeners who think that they do not know anything about the political ecology of sort of like water and water conflicts, and you, dear listener, are wrong. In fact, for me, doing a PhD on this topic, there was a lot of unlearning that had to occur. And this book is, I would say, there's a lot of myth-busting going on in this book. Would you just take a minute to talk about some of the discourses you're writing against? You can select one or two of the cases and describe them if you think that's interesting. For example, like several secretary generals of the United Nations have said statements that this book shows to be wrong on the conflicts in Darfur. I mean, these are prominent discourses that I'm almost certain our listeners have been exposed to. So if you just want to like sort of talk for a second about the sort of discourses you're writing against and sort of what it is that you're saying is missing from these and what it is that you think you contribute.
Crikey. So you've almost asked me to summarize the whole book there, Sydney.
Maybe in a few sentences or in a few minutes, explain what you think or what you see the sort of mainstream discourses that our listeners might have heard of.
Yeah, let's start with that.
Let's start with that. I'm not a professional interviewer.
So the mainstream discourses. The mainstream discourse as are ones that we would characterize as environmentally determinist or eco-determinist or Malthusian. And there's also a subsidiary sort of mainstream discourse, which is a liberal discourse, but I'll put that one to one side. Let me just focus on the eco-determinist, environmental determinist, Malthusian arguments in relation first to water, and then I bring in climate through that. So the central argument of eco-determinist or environmental determinist or Malthusian work on water is that water resources are limited or finite, that there are obviously particular bits of the world where they're more limited than others. There are natural resource limits or constraints or barriers or thresholds or carrying capacities. That creates a problem when one considers that when one brings in population growth and economic growth, because population growth means that demands on those inherently limited resources are inevitably becoming more pressured, and even more so when one considers also economic growth. So the basic model of such thinking is one of finite, limited resources, especially in particular places, and ever-growing demands and pressures on those resources, which creates a clash. And that clash is basically the consequence of that clash within Malthusian environmental determinist, eco-determinist thought is that there's growing competition for scarce resources. The idea of scarcity being absolutely central to this discourse, that competition can lead to conflict, can result in outmigration, where there are limited resources, people don't have enough to cope and have to migrate, can lead to social conflict and in turn to a bigger political conflict, including potentially international conflict, political or even military. So that's the sort of basic starting point of such thinking, and it's really this and it's that basically that model which has tended to inform thinking about future water wars, for instance, that within context of population growth and economic development, pressures on scarce resources like the River Nile or the Euphrates, where there are also extra dimensions, because in those cases they're transboundary rivers on which there is sometimes, in some cases, a high degree of dependency, especially by downstream communities and states, that the pressures on those resources from population growth and economic growth create almost inevitable tendency towards increased competition and conflict. So that's the basic sort of water wars type picture. How does that relate to climate change? Well, the mainstream discourse on climate security basically operates with a similar model, but brings in climate change on top. Climate change being associated or thought to be likely to be associated both with an increase in short-term weather shocks, and those short-term weather shocks, especially droughts figure very strongly in the literature on the discussions of climate-related conflict. Short-term weather shocks, droughts, especially like 2 or 3 year droughts, can lead to much less availability of resources, lead to short-term scarcities, conflicts over them, out-migration, conflict. Conflict dynamics relating more from long-term trends related to climate change. So changing rainfall patterns, changing temperatures, which not just through shocks, but through sort of long-term processes are projected to lead to reduced water availability. So that's the basic type of idea that dominates within both climate and water security thinking. Is that okay?
That's perfect, because you have like the audience get this idea, and then you have almost a single like sentence in this book that I have used several times, which is that in reality, water flows uphill towards money and power. And that I think makes clear, maybe you could just explain sort of the meaning of that sentence and the ways in which things like virtual water allow that to be true, because I think that that sort of framework shows what's wrong with this main discourse.
Yeah, so that phrase comes from Mark Reisner and his famous book Cadillac Desert about the transformation of the water landscape and water politics in the American West. But actually, more accurately, it comes from Tony Allen, who is a geographer based at the University of London, who is the main name associated with the idea of virtual water. So I won't go into virtual water, just to say that it was Tony Allen that I think said water flows towards money and power. Reisner just said money. Reisner's argument and what Reisner shows looking at the American West is that the economic and technological transformation of the waterscapes of the American West are so extreme that water doesn't follow natural patterns anymore. Obviously, it follows some natural patterns. When it rains, it goes downhill. But a lot of the time, if you look at where water is going, you see it going through major canals, being pumped uphill. Okay? Being pumped uphill on the basis of made possible by the construction of huge canal networks and systems, huge infrastructures, made possible by the capital and the expertise that enabled those infrastructures to be built, made possible by the capital, the money that is required to pump water uphill, and so on. And more broadly, that the picture, that phrase and the picture that Reisner offers there is one which we think doesn't just apply to the American West, but holds true globally, which is that the transformation of waterscapes worldwide and the centrality of some of that non-water stuff in making those transformations happen, forms of capital availability, expertise, the power of the state, so on and so forth. Those things, one needs to center those things in order to understand where water goes and who gets water. Effectively what we argue on that basis is that the Malthusian or environmental determinist or eco-determinist model is the wrong place to start if one wants to understand questions of water security and insecurity, and by extension, questions of climate security. What one needs to foreground instead are the ways in which nature has been and continues to be appropriated, transformed, exploited, and so on, and the various forms of and patterns of security and insecurity that are the corollaries of those transformations. So, maybe it helps just to give an example of this. I mean, the clearest example would be in relation, let's say, to Israel-Palestine, where there is a situation which in many ways is analogous to that which Reisner describes. So Israel-Palestine, broadly speaking, rainfall pattern in Israel-Palestine is that it rains more towards the north, and it rains more in with rainfall levels declining as one moves south and towards the Negev Desert, and that it rains more in the upland areas over the upland areas of the sort of headwaters of the Jordan Valley and the Galilee and the West Bank. But that natural pattern of water availability, and we'd need to add the sort of flow of the Jordan River and Lake Galilee and so on, that natural flow of water resources tells us very little today about who has water, who has control of water, who has access to water, who has water security, who is water insecure. So, for instance, the West Bank, where, for instance, Ramallah, it rains more than it does in London annually, each year on average. Ramallah, high up in the hills of the West Bank, now imports its water from Israel. There are all kinds of political and economic reasons that we can go into for that. But the situation has very, very little to do with natural pattern of water availability.
Awesome. I think that captures it well. I'll just put a teaser in there for anyone who buys the book, which I recommend doing. There's an analogy of Gaza as Manhattan, but I think sort of like it captures some of this quite well, at least does for me. But towards the end of your book, you have 10 theses. And the second of which really interested me, I think really sums some of this discourse on water's importance per se, is that water is actually less important, or is not that important, and is becoming more or less important over time in the economic systems and in the political economy of most places. And you actually wrote an essay about this, I think, 10 years ago, explaining why water was not going to be the new oil, which is a discourse that continuously pops up. I think the most prominent place I've seen this is at the end of the famous Wall Street movie, The Big Short, in which the sort of recluse investor goes off and the only thing he's going to invest in is water, because in 30 years, the world is going to collapse and whoever owns water will apparently be in charge of everything. Could you just simply explain to our audience why it is that water is not becoming more geopolitically important, and sort of the fact that it's not actually that scarce, and sort of several of these ideas for why it is that water is not itself critical?
Yeah, great. Let me start in answer to your question by just going back to the point about how within mainstream eco-determinist thought this issue is framed. So the logic of eco-determinist thought is there are natural limits, there's ever-growing demands, there's increasing pressures. Water therefore becomes more and more politically important, is the basic premise there, which they think may well or is likely to spill over into conflict. So there's a host of reasons really to doubt that reasoning. Some of that has to do with population, and some of it has to do with the nature of resources and water resources. So the bit about population is that eco-determinist thought, Malthusian thought, is really sort of mistaken in terms of their simply negative understanding of how increased population increases pressures on resources. And the central reason that it's mistaken is that that people are not only consumers of the earth resources, including water resources, but also producers of those resources, and that increased population as a result tends not to simply be correlated with negative and nasty things happening. To the contrary, it's quite clear that population rises, including sudden immigrations, can be correlated with increased economic growth, for instance, and productivity and production. So there's a whole question of population, which clearly more could be said about. But then also there's the question of resources, and the central issue here is that water is is frankly not in any meaningful sense in relation to this issue, finite or limited in the way that Malthusians think it of as being. Of course, water is finite in the sense that there's only so much of it on the planet, but there's frankly a huge amount of it on the planet. Much of it can, of which, can potentially be used and turned into a resource. One of the things that we emphasize here, and maybe this is the main thing to emphasize sort of theoretically, is that resources, it's a mistake to think of resources, including water resources, as a given, which are outside of or separate from human activity. To the contrary, resources are always produced. Things which are previously not resources can, through technological and economic development and social change, become or be made into resources. So seawater is not a meaningful water resource, at least for drinking or agricultural purposes, until the advent of desalination technology. Sewage water, wastewater, is not necessarily a resource unless it's treated as such, and so on. So new resources can be born and created, and that certainly applies to water. And in the process, water can be used more than once, and often is used more than once. So, and as soon as one recognizes that, then the idea to do with natural limits and thresholds rather sort of disintegrates very quickly. And that becomes even more so the case, more evidently the case, when one appreciates how much water is traded. By which I mean, I should emphasize, not traded in physical form, because water is so heavy, it can't really be traded internationally in physical form, but in terms of its use to produce commodities, especially agricultural commodities, which are then traded. And this takes us to the concept of virtual water, referring to the international trade in agricultural and industrial commodities, especially agricultural commodities, in which water is effectively, in which there is a water footprint, effectively. So, and the importance of that, I should say, is that the idea of virtual water, certainly as it was developed by Tony Allen and then developed by all kinds of international, propounded by all kinds of international organizations, was that states which are short of facing issues of water scarcity, water shortage, should consider moving some of their water consumption out of the agricultural sector. So move it out of agriculture, use that water for more high value industrial, domestic, and also high value agricultural purposes. So stop growing wheat, use it for more high value purposes, and then import the wheat instead. Okay. So, which is relatively straight, it's problematic in various ways that we end up exploring in the book. But for all of these reasons, the idea that X state in a relative, which has relatively low rainfall, is limited by, has a sort of set amount of water resources at its disposal, is mistaken. Now, what follows from that, and this comes to the question of, is water becoming more politically important or not, is that I think there are good reasons to say that it's not becoming more politically or indeed economically important. And to think about that, it's relatively straightforward, really. You need to think about, okay, if water is something which is produced or can be produced, are the costs of producing that water increasing or decreasing? And by large, they are decreasing. More than that, most surface and groundwater is used for agriculture, is used for irrigation. What's happening to the economic importance of agriculture? Well, broadly speaking, There are definitely ups and downs and there's variations, but broadly speaking, in the long historical sweep associated with economic development, it's been of decreasing importance. So for these and other reasons, we say there is an important, so there's important counter tendency to the increasing pressures on water resources that there undoubtedly are from population and economic growth. And that that counter tendency is probably the more important and the more powerful of the two tendencies. So overall, that's why we argue that in many ways we can see the importance of sort of political importance of water, political and economic importance of water as in decline, not as increasing.
Awesome. We are coming to the end of the interview, but I have a few more questions I want to get in. The most impressing of which is that if, as you've pointed out, right, water is not increasing in its geopolitical or economic importance over time, the technology, the cost of getting it out are decreasing. Furthermore, water doesn't seem in and of itself to be driving violent conflicts. Then what is driving the larger discourse on water wars? I know that you've written other places and in this book a bit about the discourses around sort of climate conflict and water and conflict, but would you give our audience sort of like a brief sort of explanation for why it is that this discourse continues to come up, even though the facts aren't that in question?
There's a range of difference. There's a range of reasons, and there are slightly different reasons also between water and climate. But I guess what maybe two things in general terms that I would highlight, and one is that there undoubtedly is sort of an intuitively commonsensical quality to an initially appealing quality to claims about limits and shortage leading to more conflict, and lots of people can be immediately it's easy to be immediately impressed by those the very tangible quality of water and the very tangible quality of climate and the changes to the Earth's climate and to things like drought makes it very easy to imagine and to grasp that this might be having important political implications, which I think is one of the reasons that it's voiced by people and one of the reasons it's taken up and then reproduced. But then in addition to that, I think there are a whole host of interests which lie behind why this discourse is reproduced, and maybe I can explain this in relation to climate change and maybe one of my cases that might be easiest to do. So maybe in relation to Syria is the case where this is clearest. So one of the cases that we examine in the book is the claim that climate change was an important factor in the start of the Syrian civil war, and we show that the evidence on this is pretty thin and give an alternative explanation. But we also do some reflecting on where this discourse came from. And where did it come from? Well, to start with, it comes from the Assad regime, who pre-civil war were taking diplomats up to the northeast of the country and taking them on tours up there and telling them the area was being destroyed by global warming. What they weren't telling people and what was really going on was that the area was being destroyed by state-sanctioned over-exploitation of local water resources. So one can very immediately see in an example like that how invoking climate change serves, at least for the Assad regime, as something like an excuse and as an exercise in anti-politics. So from there, the claims by the Assad regime were taken up, first by UN organizations, the Food and Agricultural Organization. They took the claims up partly because it sort of appealed to them as an organization and to show how seriously they take the problem of climate change, and partly because they didn't want to say anything too critical of the Assad regime either. They needed to work there. So it's a type of claim that was very attractive to them and international organizations. And then they reproduced it. Then lots of journalists turned up, and especially foreign and Western journalists, not really particularly knowing the area, turn up, and you go and visit some parched fields and take a few pictures of them that look like drought. And you can very easily link that to a sort of sensationalist story in the Western press about global warming, causing serious problems, and from there the claims got taken up, especially on by organizations concerned with the conflict security implications of climate change, so national security, defense planning organizations, US, European. And also on the political left, especially on the sort of red, green, or radical left, who wanting swift action on climate change, who are very happy to take up these claims as part of their sort of evidence of, like, look, this is how serious climate change is, and how urgent it is that quicker action is taken. So a host of different reasons why these claims can be attractive, and we frankly found similar things in some of the other cases as well. So I'll stop there with that bit. Hope that's reasonably clear.
Yeah, no, that's reasonably clear. You did mention, just to one follow up question on this. You did mention that the reasons for the water discourse are slightly different. Could you explain that? Because I think that's an important distinction. Is that sort of the discourse on water is not the same as the discourse on climate conflict, even though they speak to each other, are related, and both have problems with Malthusianism.
Yeah, so I think probably the water conflict discourse has been propounded above all by local riparian states, especially by those states which are in a sort of defensive position in relation to the water resources. So Israel, for instance, the dominant party on the Jordan Basin water resources, or Egypt, the dominant party on the Nile, have often invoked a water wars, water conflict typed discourse, linking it, and this comes back to the point about the tangibility of water, to sort of the sort of water is life. If you take away our water, it's an existential threat to the nation. So that type of reasoning is quite central within a water conflict discourse, and that's obviously a little bit different in relation to climate. And also the thing I mentioned last in relation to climate change, the way in which climate conflict discourse has been taken up within international forum by the left to argue for swifter action on climate change. That type of reasoning clearly doesn't apply in the same way to in relation to water wars discourse.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm just going to read this into the record and give you a chance to comment on it, and then go to our closing questions. But at the end of this book, which, again, I really do recommend the listeners get, it's full of lots of interesting sort of like details. It develops the argument really well. It will help you unlearn things. Is it at the most general level? What underpins all of this are the two intersecting master logics of the world, modern world politics, capitalism and the state system. I don't know if you want to sort of comment on this. If you think is a good way of broadly approaching environmental issues or political ecology, because this is put towards the end in an intervention sort of that you talked about a little at the beginning, of trying to think theoretically about what a larger scale political ecology might look like. So if you just want to like comment on that or not, then we can go to the final questions.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much I want to comment on that thing, to be honest. I mean, do you want to... I'm not quite sure how to take that point further, really. I'm hoping that that's been reasonably clear from what I've said. Is there something particular that you want me to explore on that point, Sydney?
No. I just wanted to make sure that sort of I was going to leave our readers or our listeners, sorry, with that, and I wanted to make sure that you were okay with leaving them at that as the summary point of like sort of what of a way to think about the insights from the book of the interview.
I think what I'd like to stress, and apologies if this, if you were going to come to this, but I think what I'd like to stress is that overall the argument that we make is not that water or climate change are not important. That they don't have conflict and security and insecurity implications. That's not our argument. Our argument rather is that. The Malthusian eco-determinist thinking is not the right place to start if one really wants to understand them, or provides only a little part of the picture. And maybe this is a way of answering the question about capitalism and the state system, because what we show through the book is that actually water has been in lots and lots of ways hugely important politically and for livelihoods and for forms of suffering. So we examine displacement through dam building, something which doesn't figure within eco-determinist reasoning really at all. We examine the ways in which processes of sort of water and land grabbing within what we call frontier regions of each of a number of our divided environments, and the way in which those processes of internal colonization of land, often focused and often targeted on the water resources, have led to displacements and conflict and violence. With those two examples, hopefully that gives some indication of how we don't see water as something which is politically inconsequential. Quite the contrary, we think that it needs understanding in a slightly different way. And the implication of that for climate change is that actually we do think there are important conflict implications of climate change, but we think these will only partly be to do with, frankly, changes in the weather. We consider just as important, if not more important, as likely to be the political and conflict implications of adaptation projects, of processes of mitigation, of changing forms of politics and identity, and possibly new forms of racialization, which are. We think are likely to emerge, and to some extent are already emerging, in relation to climate change. So, what we try to give is a slightly different account of how we think climate change matters politically and in terms of conflict. One which doesn't foreground changes to weather and questions of drought and changing water availability, that type of thing, nearly as much as most accounts do. And I guess the link there to capitalism and the state system is that how those things play out, we see the questions of the nature of contemporary capitalism, how it's how it might be transformed, state projects, state interests as crucial to whether and how processes of adaptation, mitigation, identity formation, and so on lead to conflict and insecurities.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for being here. The traditional last question on the New Books Network is there a book or an article or something you're reading now, whether it's in your field or for pleasure, that you would like to recommend to our listeners? Or I guess you can just look at your desk and tell me what it is that you're reading.
What am I reading? Okay.
Yes.
What am I reading? What I'm reading at the moment is On Barak's book, Powering Empire, How Coal Made the Middle East and Sparked Global Carbonization. which is a really, really, really terrific book. Very, very thought-provoking. Centers Cole within the history, within especially 19th century history of the making of the Middle East by Britain in particular, 19th and early 20th century. So centers coal instead of oil, and has a very, very rich and interesting account of energy transitions, and of the way in which the introduction of coal into the Middle East's political economy also involved changes in the use of animals, in water, and land, and all kinds of other things. So I haven't read it all yet, but it's absolutely fascinating.
Awesome. And then finally, I will put a link in this book to any place you tell me to recommend this, but do you have a favorite bookshop that you'd like to recommend people get the book from?
Oh, do I have a favorite bookshop?
You don't have to. Not everyone does. I just give you a chance.
I will pass on that one, I'm afraid.
All right. Sounds good. Well, just to put it into the record, Professor Selby is an acting professor of politics and international relations at the University of Sheffield. He wrote his PhD in sociology at Lancaster in 2002. He's been working for about 20 years on all the types of things that we've talked about today. He's an excellent scholar, and we're really happy to have had him. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much, Sydney.